Furlong Reel 4. What was the origins of the nickname for the Mars Farmans you were flying when they were likened to canary cages?
Well, the story went, you see, the thing had so many struts and so many wires and cross bracings and whatnot, that the story went round that when the rigger had finished rigging, he put a canary inside, and if it got out, there must be a wire missing. And that was, of course, a popular story that went round.
How much formal instruction did you get from these service instructors at Harlaxton?
Well, strange to say, in those days it was more or less left to the instructor to devise his own method of instructing. I don't think there were any books on the subject, and each instructor appeared to, and it certainly happened when I was an instructor, you got up your own ideas as to how to train, and you told the fellow what happened on the ground. You then took him up in the air and showed him what happened, demonstrated the controls, how they worked, and then you let him have a go. And if necessary, correcting while he was doing it, otherwise telling him afterwards what he'd done wrong. This was the system, and of course the way they train now is simply an extension of that, and it's been formalised right up.
Now, apart from the Farmans, the Rumpetys, you also flew Martinside Scouts and DH-4s at Harlaxton. What do you make of the Martinside Scout? What was that like to fly?
Well, it wasn't a scout in the true sense of the words. It was simply a single-seater and a bit faster than some of the others, but it wasn't a very nice machine to fly.
Why not?
Well, it was heavy. I don't think I'd like to have been a scout, as they call fighter pilots in those days. They were all scouts. They didn't call them fighter machines. Because it didn't throw about very easily. And I think you'd have been a sitting duck for any of the more modern machines. Anyway, it was used as a trading machine, and it was cheap and cheerful, I suppose, if you broke it. That was
Yeah.
the chief effect.
What about the DH-4? How was that?
Well, the DH-4 was a lovely machine. That was a first-class machine. It was fast, the fastest machine in the air at that time. And in fact, you were told, and you should realise, that your safest way of escape was to turn and run, because you were faster than the other chap, and you could fly higher most of the time.
What were its sort of handling characteristics?
Very good. It wasn't an aerobatic machine. It wasn't strong enough. It was too light, really. You could do a few aerobatics, but it wasn't a good thing to do. Nothing like some of the others. So it really relied on its climb and its speed, and that's what it was famous for. Because it was a bomber, it was a light bomber.
Do you remember any particular flying incidents involving the DH-4?
Well, I had a crash, yes. I was flying on a training flight of some sort, I don't know where, quite somewhere near Lincoln or between Lincoln and Nottingham, when the engine cut out. I was on my own. And I looked round for a field, and by sheer luck, I managed to get down in one piece. And I made my way to a farmhouse and phoned up. And the instructor said, "Well, I'm glad you've managed to get down without breaking it. I've got machines down all around the country. Can you fly up?" And I said, "Well, it's a very small field." Well, he said, "Have a go." So I went and the farmer put me up for the night. Next day, a chap arrived in a sidecar, he and the sidecar driver, and they set to work to find out what was wrong, a pipe broken or something. Anyway, they got it going. They decided the field was fairly small. So we wheeled it right to the back end of the field, and they gave me what's known as a flying start. In other words, they held me back while I got the engine going flat out. Well, it didn't make much difference. When they let go, I was still stuck. I was in this plough stuff. Anyway, they rocked me up and down until the machine managed to lurch forward, and it gradually lumbered along. And about two-thirds across the field, I realised I wasn't going to fly out of the field. So I kept going until I got to the hedge and I yanked it back. And it just jumped over the hedge and promptly stalled. And I fell in a heap on the other side. Wrapped the wings right down the machine. And I remember finishing up upside down with the wings all around me and looking through. And I could see petrol dropping on the hop engine. And it was going psht, psht, psht. And I thought, the sooner I get out of this, the better. So I fought my way out, tearing whatever I could, and climbed down. It didn't catch fire, fortunately. That was the end of that. I had hurt my elbow. I didn't know it at the time. But that was all there was to it. I became a local hero with the girls, I'm glad to say, just for that night.
Now, after you'd finished your flying training with the RFC at Waddington, you got your first operational posting. And tell me about the circumstances of that posting.
Well, I don't know how we were selected, but I found myself with some other fellows, and we understood that we were going to Italy. And whether we knew then or not that it was a Caproni triplane, I wouldn't be sure. But we were sent to Milan, to an address in Milan, which turned out to be some sort of RNAS headquarters, where we were interviewed by a semi-senior officer, commander, or possibly a wing commander. And we were then told that we were going to fly Capronis with the idea of boosting the morale of the Italians, which wasn't very good at the time. We were told that the only knowledge that the Italians had of the British was extremely good. There had been a British squadron there some while before, which had got a terrific reputation. And whatever we did, we were not to spoil that. And generally, our instructions were that we had to, shall we say, show off a bit. That was the idea.
Mm. Now, your posting was actually to Gallarate, which was a bit northwest of Milan.
Yes.
When you got to Gallarate, did you observe there any of the malaise which the RNAS officer at Milan had told you existed in the Italian Air Service?
Yes, it was fairly obvious right from the start that the Italians, to put it our way, didn't want to fly. We were used to the idea in the RFC, I beg your pardon, of the pupils being anxious to fly, being out on the field waiting for their turn. There was nothing like that about the Italians. They all had to be called for their turn. They had to be sort of pulled out of the mess, more or less, and said, now it's your turn to fly, off you go. Whereas we were sitting on the airfield waiting for our opportunity.
Was your impression that this was a morale problem, or on the other hand, that it was just that the Italians didn't appear to take to flying very naturally?
I felt it was a morale problem. They didn't seem to have the same outlook at all as the British. We couldn't understand it. We were all very young, remember? We couldn't understand it, but they didn't seem to have anything like the interest in flying, the pupils I'm talking about, the instructors, and I suppose it's mostly instructors, were wonderful pilots and wonderful instructors, and they used to fly and fly for the fun of it and gave some wonderful exhibitions. It was the pupils that seemed to be so lackadaisical.
Now, what was the size of the British Air component at Gallarate?
Fairly small. My recollection is there were six RNAS pilots and six RFC pilots. And none others.
Did the RFC and the RNAS air components there get on amicably?
Well, there was the usual rivalry which always applied in England. We chiacked each other, which of course after a bit we realised the Italians wouldn't understand and would give a bad impression if the British seemed to be squabbling amongst themselves. So we sort of called a truce and decided that we'd have to put on a British front for the benefit of the Italians, which we did.
Now, what specific forms did this rivalry between you and your RNAS colleagues take?
Well, we understood in the early part of this that we were going to form a squadron of Capronis, of six aircraft, and the RNAS got the idea that they were going to captain all the aircraft and that we would be the dog's bodies. Each aircraft had five aboard, and this didn't seem right to us. So finally we got together, and I think I was deputised to go and see the naval bloke and say, "Look, sir, this won't do. We shall never get on properly unless you divide it up and give the RNAS three of the aircraft and the RFC three of the aircraft. It won't upset the Italians, but it will keep our rivalry healthy, and we shall feel happier flying with our own people, our own service, rather than mixed service."
So is this the way it worked out?
Yes, this was. It never actually came to fruition, but this is what was organised.
I see. You never actually got the three aircraft each.
We never actually got the three aircraft each, no.
Now, talking about the aircraft themselves, these were very large bomber aircraft, Capronis.
Yes.
Tell me about them. What were their characteristics? How did they differ from British airplanes you've flown?
Well, the Caproni biplane was a pretty big aircraft by British standards, but of course the triplane was a whopper. That was really, I believe, we were given to understand anyway, the biggest aircraft in the world at the time. And it would carry 20 112-pound bombs, which was a heck of a lot in those days. The other ones, the biplanes, I don't know what they carried, but of course they were considerably smaller. I think they were already operational. But we were set there on a conversion course, and of course we started on the biplane. None of us were multi-engine pilots at the time, so we had to learn how to fly multi-engine airplanes.
Well, exactly what new techniques did you find you had to assimilate?
Well, of course, a multi-engine aircraft is always more complicated than a single-engine aircraft, and we had to learn to fly on one engine or on two engines, and as opposed to flying on three. The biplane would still fly on two engines, and I think possibly the same applied to the triplane. But one had to learn what happened when one of the side engines shut down. Obviously, the machine had to be handled with the rudder and pretty quickly. So that sort of thing we had to learn. And our instructors were Italian with no English. So this was all done by gestures and slapping hands and so on.
What kind of signals did the Italian instructors give you?
Well, they would point to things. The instruments, of which there were very few, and if you weren't doing, say, enough bank, they would show you with their hands they wanted more bank, or if you weren't holding the stick far enough forward, they would sort of slap your hand and push your hand, so that you would know you had to push harder, whereas if they just pushed the stick, their own stick, you wouldn't know whether it was the aircraft that was, so to speak, heavy, or whether it was you doing it. And it just sort of simply by gesture, as we had no words of Italian, the airspeed indicator was a somewhat primitive affair, consisting of what we called a penny on a spring.
What was that?
A little round disc on a spring on one of the struts outside the cockpit.
How did that work?
Well, when the wind's blowing on it, it's blown backwards. And when the wind isn't so strong, it comes forward. And behind it was a plate on which were the two words minima and maxima. Well, if you let it get below minima, you stalled. And if you got above maxima, presumably the wings fell off. But that's the only indicator. There was no actual miles per hour sort of indication at all. You simply knew you had to fly within those limits.
Any other kind of instrumentation on the aircraft which was new to you?
No, simply the lack of it. There was practically nothing that I recall in the way of instruments except perhaps an oil gauge for each engine and a rev counter. I don't recall any other sort of instruments. I don't even recall an altimeter.
Did you find the lack of instrumentation was at any stage
no.
unhelpful?
It didn't worry me because I'd always learnt to fly without instruments. I was quite happy to fly without instruments most of the time.